This is not just any podcast. This is Historical Inaccuracies, a history podcast. Becky, was that good?
Not bad. I'd give it a solid 5.5 out of 10 on the...
Oh my god,
On the English scale. I'm going to start ranking you all now, by the way. I've decided. You're all getting a mark out of 10.
So you think Cam's version was better than mine?
Yes. No.
Oh, what?
Wait, what do you mean? Mine was fucking brilliant.
No, well, clearly Kelly's is the best.
Yes, that's what I'm touching Kelly. Like, that's why I'm comparing myself to Cam's. But anyway.
No, Cam's was probably about a 2 on the scale.
Oh, thank you so much. Okay, that makes me feel so much better. I'll carry on.
Aye, fucking thank you.
So, hello everyone, and welcome to episode 7, yes, of our podcast, brought to you by 4 friends, 2 Scots, Cam and Kelly. Hello.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
An English one, Becky.
Hi.
And a Greek one, moi, Maria. We like to talk in general, and more specifically, we like to talk about history, remaining religiously, historically inaccurate. Today's podcast is sponsored by nobody, so spare some thought and give us a good review, please. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all the other relevant platforms because our tech guru, Becky, has uploaded us everywhere. So please spend a moment and give us a 5-star review. Thank you.
I should say, I think we're everywhere, but if anyone notices somewhere that we are not, then please get in touch via the email address and let us know.
Oh yes, we have an email address. Becky, would you care to read it out for the audiences, please?
Oh yes, it's very simple. All lowercase, all one word. historicalinaccuraciespodcast@outlook.com.
That's us. So today, it is a special one, with special thanks to Anna, our silent collaborator, and Cam's missus. Sorry, audiences, his tongue is taken. Since we're going to be discussing... since we're going to be discussing about the great Polish leaders, hence why this is dedicated to Anna. So we've got Kelly, who's going to be starting with Jadwiga. Is that a good pronunciation of that?
Is it Jadwiga?
I think it's Jadwiga. I don't actually Jadwiga. Know. Jadwiga. It's Jadwiga, right. Yeah, definitely Jadwiga.
Jadwiga, in about like the 14th century. Then Becky's going to speak to us about Witold Pilecki around about the 1940s. And then we've got Cameron, who's going to talk to us about Wojciech the Bear.
Wojciech,
all right. Which is about around about the same time as Becky's Pilecki man. And then I'm going to be talking about a few badass women that we know of thanks to Anna again, which I think is really important to mention. Now, swiftly moving on to the historical facts of the day. Did you know, guys, that on the 10th of May in the 1940, Winston Churchill succeeded Neville Chamberlain as British Prime Minister?
Was that today, was it? Oh, yes. I see. I mean, I always feel for Neville Chamberlain because I feel like he's been much maligned in history, and mm-hmm. I think it's probably a bit of a contrast. I feel like he was the eternal optimist, whereas Winston Churchill, as great as he was probably an eternal pessimist.
I think with Neville Chamberlain, I think his heart, you know, when people say his heart's in the right place, but his mind's up his arse or something like that, you know, and I think that saying couldn't be really kind of truer for Neville Chamberlain, because it's true though. I think he genuinely wanted peace. He genuinely wanted mm-hmm. to avoid a Second World War, and I think he believed in his heart of hearts that he could avoid this. But I think eventually he probably came to the realization that, like, well, you know, this short arse with a pencil fucking moustache isn't going to back down. And I think obviously, you know, they had to let someone who, I mean, Chamberlain was actually quite a soft-spoken man, so they obviously had to let somebody with a bit of kind of like bull in them to take forward, you know. So I do kind of think, I'm kind of with Becky in this one, I do think that history kind of like paints him quite a negative picture. And I'd like to say this as well, just quickly. If you ever kind of watch a few American TV shows and stuff like that, you know, they always talk about appeasement and say, oh, you know, Chamberlain and stuff like that. And I kind of think to myself, yes, well, you know, Chamberlain did try and keep us out of the war, but just remember, you fuckers didn't fight for a good, 2-3 years? So remember that.
And there's only so much you can reason, try and reason with someone that's unreasonable. So, like, he tried up until a point where he realised that the man that he was trying to reason with could not be reasoned with. And then at that point, he had to go, I'm afraid.
Thank you for your comments, guys. Now we're going to swiftly move on to a sweet and short introduction to Poland, and then I'll pass it on to my wonderful friends to enlighten us about those figures. So, Poland is located in Central Europe, and it, of course, has been subjugated by loads of groups of invaders, ranging from Germans to Balts to Mongols. And in the mid-1500s, United Poland was the largest state in Europe and perhaps the continent's most powerful nation. I will skip the pedantic details for another episode and skip to 1910s, where, as the restored nation in 1918, Poland suffered tremendously throughout the course of the 20th century, see World War I and World War II. And World War II was particularly damaging as Poland's historically strong Jewish population, of course, was almost annihilated in the Holocaust. But with the fall of the Third Reich, Poland effectively lost its independence once again, becoming a communist sort of state of the Soviet Union. But then in May 1989, the Polish government fell along with communist regimes throughout Eastern Europe, beginning Poland's rapid transformation into a democracy. Now, throughout the history, Polish culture has informed those of the Great American Revolution. And of course, then the Polish Constitution of 1791, which is the oldest in Europe, in turn incorporated ideals of the American and French revolutions. And in that point, I should say that Poland, it's the first European country and second country overall to have written a constitution, although it has changed since, but it was the first one, which is, I think, amazing. Now, Polish intellectuals, musicians, filmmakers, and writers continue to enrich the world's arts and letters, and some of them are Chopin, Rubinstein, Joseph Conrad. I was like blown. My mind was blown when I realized that Joseph Conrad, the author of Heart of Darkness, was like Polish. Like, what? And of course, Marie Curie, Badass Queen. We've got Lee Strasberg and Roman Polanski, just to name a few. So I'll give you a few brief facts about Poland and then I'll pass on to Kelly. So did you know that on the September 1st, 1939, Poland was invaded by Germany despite never having made a declaration of war? Crazy. It remained the only European country to neither cooperate or surrender a battle to the Nazis. How badass is that?
Very badass.
All right. Now, another crazy fact, Napoleon Bonaparte met his Polish mistress. Actually, he had a Polish mistress. I didn't know that. One of the famous ones, Countess Maria Waleska or Waleska. She was Polish. I had no idea. And the Polish people have won a total of 17 Nobel Prizes. What? And that includes 4 peace prizes, and 5 in literature. And final fact, on July 20th, 1944, Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg made his courageous, though unsuccessful, attempt to assassinate Hitler at the Wolf's Lair in northeastern Poland.
He's the one with one eye in the claw, isn't he?
Yes, yes. And he was played by Tom Cruise in one of them. I think I remember Tom Cruise playing him, unless I'm completely like...
Valkyrie.
Yes. So that was me, and I'll pass on to Kelly to start.
Yes, okay, so Jadwiga, this is your life. That's not even remotely the This Is Your Life theme, but you know. So I have chosen the Polish king and saint, two of our titles, Jadwiga. I chose her because I was actually in Krakow. I went to Krakow for the first time in February for my birthday. And just if anyone has ever thought about going to Krakow, like, go. It is like 100% like my favourite city break I've ever been on. Like, the food, the culture, everything's just amazing.
Oh, it's beautiful, isn't it? It's
fantastic. It is. Honestly, I was so sad when I had to leave. It was just amazing. But yeah, one of the things that kind of struck me as well from that trip. So we went to a few different places. We went to Wawel Cathedral, and I actually went to Jadwiga's tomb and saw, I was just so fascinated by the fact that she was a king and not a queen, which kind of, when we decided to do this podcast, I was like, it is a no-brainer, I'm going to do Jadwiga and find out more about her, because I wanted to know more about her while I was there as well. I mean, I found out a little bit, but yeah, I had quite a good time totally reading up about her life for a good few hours yesterday. So, but she had a very drama-filled life, so I will try not go on for too long. So, Jadwiga, or Hedwig, as she is more commonly known in the Hungarian, believe it or not, which is, you know, makes you think if J.K. Rowling got Hedwig's name from that, but I mean, I don't know, maybe she did. She was born in Hungary, actually, so ironically, she is not actually Polish, but she was a Polish leader. She was born in Buda, which is now part of modern-day Budapest in Hungary, in either 1373 or 1374. They're not 100% sure on the date. She was the third and youngest daughter of King Louis I, who was King of Hungary and Poland. So at that point, under King Louis, Poland and Hungary were united in a sort of personal union, so quite similar to what James VI and I had when he became King of England and Britain. So a sort of similar situation to that. So Jadwiga was the third and youngest daughter of Louis and his second wife, Elizabeth of Bosnia. Now, in reading about this, I could totally do a completely different podcast on Elizabeth of Bosnia. She was like another very like ambitious, like badass lady, but I'll probably mention a little bit about her further on, but I'm not going to go into it too much because she deserves her own like podcast, to be honest. And Jadwiga's two older sisters were Catherine and Mary. So King Louis had no sons, but he did want to ensure his daughter's rights to inherit both of his realms. Take notes, Henry VIII, is all I'm saying there. So he basically wanted to, one of the main things of his reign once he had his daughters was that he wanted to make sure that when he died that they would take over. And very similar, I think when I was reading it in this, there's a lot of parallels between that and the anarchy. So I think him and Henry I would get on, because he was very much adamant that he wanted his daughter to succeed him and not have like a male cousin or something inherit, which is like justice for Empress Matilda. I'm just saying that like right now. So the fact that he planned to do this made the three of his daughters exceptionally attractive bridal prospects in Europe at that time. So basically every single dickhead man who thought, all right, this is a good opportunity, because at that time, if a man married the daughter of a king, he would automatically inherit the titles and her wealth and blah, 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 as her husband. So naturally, all the wee dickheads were like, oh yes, like we've got like, he's wanting to give his daughters all this power, but if we marry his daughters, then we'll get the power rather than them. But, this is part of the reason why Jadwiga was crowned king and not queen. So we'll come into that later on. So one of the things that Louis did to make sure that his daughters would inherit, had the right to inherit his lands, was in 1374, he signed the privilege of, now I'm really sorry if I butcher this this pronunciation, I think I might do this with a few things as we go on, so apologies and disclaimer in advance. The privilege of Kozice, which was essentially an agreement where Louis agreed to give all of the Polish lords released from their duties, so like they would no longer have to pay tribute to him, they would no longer have to build new castles and towns and bridges, and they would no longer have to like repair them, and they would also no longer have to, so if the king was traveling within Poland and he needed, so in the Middle Ages it was like the sort of nobles had to give like their lodgings and like their food and everything for like the king and his court if they were traveling. But as part of this agreement, they would essentially give that up, so they wouldn't have to provide this anymore. So if you think about it, there's a lot of kind of kingly benefits that Louis was willing to give up in exchange for the Polish lord swearing fealty to his daughters. So he's a pretty sound guy, like Louis, from what it seems for his day. He seems to be, he's very much, he wants his daughters to inherit no matter what cost, basically, which I thought was pretty touching. She actually, Jadwiga, both of Jadwiga's parents seemed pretty sound, so, or bad, or as much as you can have that back in like 1300s, but So that was agreed. So the Polish lord were like, yes, we'll not have to pay fuel, we'll not have to do all this, that. And the next thing, we'll just sign this oath that essentially swears that we would support, at this time it was Louis's oldest daughter, Catherine, and becoming his heir when he died, essentially. So that was all signed, sealed and delivered. In Poland, crucially, not in Hungary at this point. So by this point, Jadwiga, who was literally an infant, was already engaged to William of Austria. But, however, in 1378, Catherine, Louis's eldest daughter, died. So Louis at this point went, fuck, because he had, essentially, it was Catherine who was the named person in all of these negotiations that he had done for, like, his inheritance, basically. So at this time, he went, when his daughter died, Louis went back to the Polish lords, the most influential ones, and essentially persuaded them to swear a new oath of loyalty to his second daughter, Mary, as his heir. And in 1379, this was agreed, and the Polish lords did that. After this point, she was then engaged again as, what, she was like three or something at this point, Mary. She was engaged to Sigismund of Luxembourg, which was crucially, now this match was approved by the Hungarian lords in Louis's Hungarian kingdom. And according to Polish lords, they think, all the time, they think that Louis planned to persuade the Hungarian lords also to accept Jadwiga and Mary as heirs to his throne in Hungary. So they think that they planned to do essentially what he had planned to do, essentially what he did in Poland to Hungary, so that the daughters, his daughters would be heirs to both kingdoms. But crucially, Louis died before this could happen. So he died on the 11th of September 1382 with the 8 or 9 year old Jadwiga at his bedside. So
that's sad.
Yeah, so she was with him when he died, which it seems to be, yeah, it seems to be, I think he would be very much be, or they would all be pretty much daddy's girls, I feel, if that was like in a modern day context. He seemed to be really close to his daughters and seemed to genuinely love his daughters, which is quite, I thought that was quite nice for like the 1300s, considering you've got people like that. Well, most people were just pure rampant for sons, basically.
Women were not the flavour of the month for several centuries.
No, and if you had three daughters at that point, everyone would be like, oh, I could like practically hear Henry VIII like screeching for the flames about that. So King Louis was a different breed. Entirely. So it was quite sad when he died. But 5 days after he died, Mary, his daughter, his second daughter, was crowned King of Hungary. And she was 12 at this point. So she was secured and crowned as King and not Queen. This was at the behest of her mother, Elizabeth, who was going to be her regent. And she made sure to secure the fact that she was crowned as King because basically in both Hungary and Poland, now this is from what I can understand, if anyone's heard any different to this, then please do feel free to jump in and correct me, but from what I understand, the law in Hungary and Poland at that time under the personal union was that a ruler or a regnant, so like a king regnant, had to be a king, otherwise there was no, like, you couldn't be a regnant unless you were a king. There was no such thing as a queen regnant, and there was no stipulation of gender in this. Now this is probably because of like misogyny, they just assumed that there was never ever going to be a situation where a woman would be a regnant, so that's why they didn't stipulate if by king it had to be a man or a woman. So obviously that's what Elizabeth and Louis were like, well, doesn't say gender, doesn't say that to be a king you have to be a man, so they kind of like jumped on that essentially.
Love it.
And this, well, exactly, and it also secured Mary the right to rule on her own right instead of her fiancé. So she was a regnant. When her husband came into power, he could only be joint ruler with her. He would never be able to be regnant while she was regent, his co-queen, if that makes sense. So that essentially she is the main ruler, basically. And it essentially secured her, by being king, it secured her from her husband taking that right, if that makes sense. Does that sound like...
Yes, it makes sense to me.
All right, cool. I realise sometimes it can be like sound a bit complicated, so I just wanted to check that makes sense. So from what I understand, that is why Mary was crowned king in Hungary. And from what I understand as well, I don't think... I'm going to come to this later, and Cam, I'm sure you would maybe correct me on this, I also don't think that there was such a thing or a term as like a queen in Polish, like a queen regnant, so that's why Jadwiga was eventually crowned as king, but like, well, we can come back to that once we get on to Jadwiga. So Mary and Jadwiga's, at this point, were both engaged to foreign princes, and this was very unpopular in Poland. So essentially at this point, Mary is king in Hungary, but she's not king in Poland, because the Polish lords were basically like, we don't want a king that lives in Hungary, we want a king that lives and does the business in Poland, essentially. So this kind of confused me, because Louis was king of both Hungary and Poland as just one man. But I mean, I'm assuming he resided in Poland, and the Hungarians were maybe a bit more sound about him not being in Hungary. I don't really know how this came about, but basically, because Mary was king in Hungary and was therefore expected to be in Hungary all the time, Polish lords were like, well, why should we be ruled by her? She's in a different country. We need like an actual Polish ruler to reside in Poland, basically. Which Mary obviously could not do, because she was already residing and accepted in Hungary as king. So Elizabeth, our favourite, political machinist mother that she was, basically proposed, okay, well, Mary can't be king in Poland, but I've got another daughter, Jadwiga can be king in Poland. So she basically wanted to send Jadwiga to live and rule in Poland as king, separately from Mary. So they would still be King Louis's daughter, so there would still be a kind of union there, but obviously it wouldn't be through one of them, it would be through both of the daughters. So
genius.
Exactly. So another thing to note as well is part of the Polish lords' acceptance of King Louis's terms, in terms of like his daughter's inheriting him as King of Poland, was that she had to reside in Poland as well. So that's another thing that the lords were kind of jumping on with Mary. They were like, well, the agreement for us to accept one of your daughters as king would be that she has to actually live in Poland, and Mary's not living in Poland, so that's why Elizabeth was like, we'll send Jadwiga, basically. So this, the fact that Elizabeth, Elizabeth, who had her head screwed on properly, then was like, right, we'll send Jadwiga, this actually prevented, so in Poland they were actually planning to elect a new king, so once they heard that Mary was now king in Hungary, they were like, oh, we'll elect a new king, because we won't have to uphold our oath to Louis anymore. So they had planned to elect a guy called Siemowicz of Masovia. But when Elizabeth said, look, don't worry, Jadwiga's coming, she's going to be your king, she is still one of Louis's daughters who you swore fealty to, the Polish lords were like, all right, okay then, we'll accept Jadwiga. But Siemowicz was like, I'm not happy with this. I was going to be elected king. I was going to get all the power. So he essentially rebelled, or started a rebellion at Jadwiga's impending rule. This was before Jadwiga even arrived in Poland. He basically rose up an army and basically tried to take all these towns, and like as a show of like, I'm the rightful king, I'm going to get elected, blah, blah, blah. But then it became increasingly unpopular in Poland because his soldiers were very brutal towards Polish people in terms of, you know, rape and pillaging and all that horrible stuff that they like to do. So he basically, his popularity went, and so by that point, by the time that Jadwiga had actually arrived in Poland, that put paid to any support that he had. They were like, Sigis, or what's his name, Siemowicz, is just, yeah, he was just out of the picture by that point. So his little opportunistic rebellion did not work, safe to say. So Jadwiga, when Jadwiga eventually did arrive in Poland, this was celebrated, and on 16th of October 1384, at the grand old age of 10/11, we're not really 100% sure, she was crowned King of Poland in Krakow. Yay, Jadwiga, she's here. So, because she was so young, she did have several advisors who became her most close and trusted aides that helped her rule in the early years of her reign. So one of these was the Bishop of Krakow. And even though she had like this big crew of advisors around her, there was a sort of debate about historians. So at one point, there was a lot of historians that said, oh, there's no way that she could have ruled in her own right. She was very much a puppet of these advisors because, you know, she was young, she was this, that, and the next thing. But actually, according to like contemporary accounts, she actually, for an 11-year-old, she was at the start. She apparently matured like really quickly. The other thing as well is that I thought was quite, again, it speaks to like the strength of her, because when you think about it, Elizabeth, her mum, stayed with Mary in Hungary. At least Mary had her mum in Hungary as her regent, whereas Jadwiga in Poland was essentially her regents, or people that were helping her rule, were just like a group of like strange men that she didn't know. And for like an 11-year-old in a foreign country with like foreign men that she didn't know, like rule, like, do you know what I mean? I feel like the experiences of Mary and Jadwiga as like kings, or like child kings, was probably so different because of that. So yeah, when you think about it, that's a lot for an 11-year-old, but by all accounts, she was very charming and she was very kind, and this very much like strengthened her position in Poland, even though she was like, again, she was like a child. There is evidence that later the same year as she was crowned, so bear in mind she's like 10 or 11 at this point, there's evidence that later the same year that she was crowned, she had already intervened on one of her advisors' behalf, a Duke Vladislaus, to reconcile him with her mother's favourite Nicholas the First Garai. Sorry if I've like totally butchered that, but so essentially they had a falling out, they weren't speaking, and she like intervened as king to like reconcile them at fucking 10 or 11 years old, which is pretty impressive, I think.
I mean, when you put that into perspective, what I think I was doing at 10 or 11, that is very impressive.
Yeah, well, I was like, at 10 or 11, I was blooming, like, I was like climbing up trees and stuff like that, like running about, like, and she's like actually running a country, and like, it's just mental, it's crazy. But yeah, so, however, even though like, so at this point, I'm conscious like I'm kind of going on and on, so please do feel free if you want to like butt in and like say anything at any point. So even though Jadwiga at this point, she's been like king for however long, and she's like a child, they all love her, like Poland's like, yay, we love Jadwiga, they did not like her fiancé that she was due to marry. So Polish lords did not accept William of Austria, who she was engaged to at this point, as their sovereign. So they made it clear that like, he's a threat to Poland's interest. If Jadwiga marries him, we're not accepting him as like co-monarch, basically. And it was very unpopular. So they advised Jadwiga instead to marry the pagan Duke Jogaila of Lithuania. Again, sorry if I butchered that name. So Jogaila sent envoys to Poland to formally request Jadwiga's hand in marriage. At this point, she's still kind of informally engaged to William of Austria. So Jogaila sent envoys to Poland to request her hand in January 1385. But when the proposal was made to Jadwiga, Jadwiga refused. Now, this is like the most typical 11-year-old response you could ever have in your life, right? Because she was 11. When the envoys asked for her hand in marriage, Jadwiga said, "You need to ask Mama." Literally, she said, My mum needs to decide. So, yeah, typical 11-year-old reaction. So the envoys were like, right, okay. But at this point, obviously, Elizabeth stayed in Hungary with her daughter Mary. So the envoys had to then reroute. So they left Poland, went to Hungary instead to ask Elizabeth, can Jogaila marry your daughter Jadwiga? And Elizabeth basically said she was up for it. Basically, what the quote says is, whatever is advantageous to the people of Poland. So basically, she said, if it's good for Poland, it's good for me. And if it's good for me, it's good for Jadwiga. So the Polish nobles voted in June or July to accept the proposal. So Jadwiga essentially didn't really get a say in who she was going to marry, which is, well, typical for that time period. But now this is where the kind of drama sets in, right? So William, in the meantime, now remember William, that was who Jadwiga was originally meant to marry when and was arranged when King Louis was alive. William's father, Leopold III, demanded at this point, he's heard that Jogaila is planning on marrying her, that Polish lords have accepted it, blah, blah, blah. He's thought, oh shit, there goes my shot at my son being like co-ruler of Poland. So he essentially wanted to force Jadwiga to marry. So they basically wanted to get Jadwiga and William, get them to marry, and then force the consummation of their marriage so that basically the marriage contract by Jogaila was like invalid, essentially.
Wait, what?
I know.
Wait. Sorry. Let's just go back a wee second here. She's like 11 at this time, right?
She is. She's 11.
The fuck?
So this is what I like. I'm going to call this, there's no really a funny way to put it. He essentially wanted to race William to essentially shag Jadwiga before she could marry Jogelia, right? She is an 11-year-old child. We'll keep that in mind as this goes on. So basically, and it's desperate. Like, it is the most desperate thing I've ever actually read in my life. So basically, William was sent to Krakow. So William was pure running now. I just like to imagine him, like, pure full speed ahead, like, running, like, so William went to Krakow in August to try and basically get in and essentially rape Jadwiga. That is essentially what it is, like, in all seriousness. But he was refused entry into Vavel Castle when he tried to get in. Obviously, that's where Jadwiga was staying at that time. So essentially what the guards were like, there'll be no shagging 11-year-olds the day, be on your way, is essentially what the guards said.
Fucking damn right.
Another thing to note as well is William's dad had actually got a dispensation from the bishop to say, because basically at that point the age of consent was 12, or the age of maturity was 12, so if he had essentially raped her, I'm going to say rape her because that's what it was, when she was still 11, it wouldn't have counted because she was not mature yet, she'd not reached her 12th birthday, but that was only unless you got a dispensation from a bishop to say that the person in question, the child in question, was mature beyond her years, which William got. So we had a letter. So if I can just imagine him, like, standing at the entrance to Vavel Castle, like, trying to get in to, like, pump this wee 11-year-old with, like, this bit of paper being like, the bishop says it's all right. She's, like, no 12 yet, but it's fine. Like, let me in. Honestly,
I could just see it now. Just go a bit of paper, and I'd be like, "Yes, lightning!"
Like, it's so bad. But safe to say, it was sent on his way by the guards at Vavel Castle. They were like, "Piss off, mate! You're not getting in." And so he essentially left Krakow with like his tail between his legs, and he never came back. Basically, but now you would think at this point that Jadwiga's dodged a bullet. Oh no, my friends. Oh no, she has not. I'm sorry to tell you. So, Jogelia, who was the ruler of Lithuania, or the heir or prince of Lithuania, and Jadwiga were married in Vavel Cathedral on 18th of February, which is my birthday, just putting it out there. They were married on the 18th of February, 1386, and this was 3 days after Jogelia had been baptised into the Roman Catholic Church, because he was a pagan before this point. And he was renamed Vladislav. Don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
Vladislav,
right. So he was renamed with the Christian name Vladislav. Now, here's the kicker, lads. By this point, Jadwiga was 12. So there was no dispensation needed. However, Vladislav was 35.
Oh, man, come on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, on the 4th of March 1386, with Vladislav being crowned as co-king alongside Jadwiga, they essentially became joint rulers of Poland. So there was now, but she was still regnant, obviously, because he had married her, he became like the co-monarch, basically. And at this point, we start to see how good a kind of ruler Jadwiga was as well, even though she was still a child. So basically, there's an account of one of their early royal visits that they'd done to Lesser Poland. Now, it's important to note that in Lesser Poland, Vladislav was not popular there at all. They did not like him. So they went there to kind of try and, or Jadwiga went with him to try and be like, oh, look, he's sound, he's not that bad a guy, blah, 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 even though he's 35 and I'm 12. When the royal party visited there was quite a lot of damage that was caused to like peasants' homes and livestock and things like that. And essentially Jadwiga, most of it was kind of caused by Vladislav. So Jadwiga said to her, she essentially persuaded her husband to compensate the peasants for what he'd essentially done to their livelihoods, basically. And she's quoted to have said, "We have indeed returned the peasants' cattle, but who can repair their tears?" She was
that
12 when she said that.
Deep 11-year-old. 12-year-old.
And 12-year-old, I was cutting a bit with a kookie bag. I was, like, obsessed with, like, Jane Norman and that.
Oh god. Oh god, the noughties.
And she's like kind of saying like really profound, like noble things. I'm just clapping and Vika that out because that is a lot of like insight for like a 12-year-old. But there's also a court record as well, which survives to this day, that she ordered judges to favour a peasant as well in a court case. So she seems to be quite a charitable lass for someone so young. Meanwhile, even though things are going rosy for Jadwiga in Poland, Hungary had descended into anarchy. Now, this is her sister's kingdom. A group of Slavonian lords. Now, thing to bear in mind is that the Hungarian and Slavonian lords were not as accepting of a female ruler as the Polish lords were, and they had also not sworn an oath to anybody, essentially saying that they would accept her. So majority of them, because they're dicks, basically believed that because Mary was a woman, she did not have the right to rule in Poland, even though she was King Louis's direct descendant, she was his daughter. They believed that the rightful ruler was a distant cousin called Charles III of Naples. So essentially there have been loads of rebellions, and at this point Mary's like 14 years old. Like, yeah, so basically there were mostly the rebellions were against her mother, who was like the regent at that time. By this point, on the 25th of July, they had rebelled and they'd captured Jadwiga's sister and her mother, and they'd imprisoned them. And they kept them prisoner for quite a while. I'm not really sure how long. But there is a whole other story as to what kind of prompted that, which I'm not going to go into because it's not to do with Jadwiga. But they're put it this way, there could be a whole other podcast on Elizabeth of Bosnia and what she did, essentially, that kind of fueled this rebellion to take place, blah, blah. But safe to say, they were both captured, they were imprisoned. Now, this is quite a horrible thing. So, essentially, Mary and Elizabeth were imprisoned for however many months, and then the Slovenian lords / guards, at one point, after a few months, kind of were sick of, like, holding them, I guess, or holding Elizabeth, so they strangled Elizabeth to death in front of her 14-year-old daughter. Which is brutal, to say the least. And now she was the regent at the time, which left Mary, now fucking traumatised if you were 14 and you'd watched your mother be strangled to death in front of you. But she was actually released because her husband, who she'd married, that Sigismund who I'd mentioned earlier, he had rallied troops and was marching on the place where they were imprisoned. So by the time he got there, the mother had been strangled to death, but Mary was still alive. They didn't want to strangle her because she was technically still king. So Sigismund essentially managed to overthrow the people that were holding them prisoner, and then Mary was freed. And her and her husband did continue ruling in Hungary until she died years later in a horse riding accident while pregnant with a stillborn son. So that's pretty tragic all round, the story of Mary and Elizabeth. A month after learning about her mum's murder, Jadwiga, in January 1387, at this point she's, oh god, how even old is she at this point, 13, marched Polish troops to Ruthenia, where all but one of the governors submitted to her because they were so kind of scandalised by the fact that her mother had been like brutally murdered. And then after her sister's death in 1395, Jadwiga basically then had beef with Sigismund, who was her sister's husband, who'd become ruler of Hungary because after his wife's death. Jadwiga had essentially by this point built up a reputation as being quite a good mediator, so she kind of like was good at kind of reconciling people and countries, and Polish and Hungarian tensions at this point were quite tense. But the Poles believed essentially that after Mary's death, Jadwiga was her rightful heir, not her husband, and this was the agreement that was secured by her parents. Now this is quite interesting. So basically the succession crisis thing that came about after Mary's death, Vlad I of Wallachia, our good friend Vlad the Impaler, some people might have heard of, Dracula. He gets involved at this point. Yes, the inspiration for Count Dracula. He gets involved at this point because Wallachia was a Hungarian vassal, so it was like a vassal state of Hungary even. So there is an actual proof that he issued an act of submission to Jadwiga on the 28th of May 1395, which acknowledged, like Vlad was acknowledging Jadwiga and her husband as heir to the Hungarian throne. And it's one of Sigismund, who was Mary's husband, who was ruling in Hungary at this point, in response to this, his supporter, Stibor of Stiborich, expelled Vlad from Valakia as a response, which led to Vlad's rebellions. Honestly, it's just a big wave that you can go into, like, loads of different things. So that was a little tangent that happened there. And I'm sorry, I'm aware I've been talking for a long time, so I'll try and wrap this up, but there's just so much that happened in Jadwiga's life, honestly.
Don't worry.
Basically, the succession crisis, peace negotiations, by the end of the year between Hungary and Poland had actually ended with a fairly amicable agreement. So Jadwiga adopted the title heir of Hungary. But her and her husband crucially took no further action against Sigismund in terms of their claims to the Hungarian throne. So they essentially were like, we're sick of this, Sigismund can rule Poland, rule Hungary essentially. But she also, in her role as a mediator, she also attempted to mediate relations between her husband's country of Lithuania and the Teutonic Knights. So the Teutonic Knights are kind of like a sort of religious military order, quite similar to the Knights Templar. So honestly, this our entire life could be made in a film. Why no one has jumped on this? I don't know. So Jadwiga met with the Grand Master of the Teutonic Knights in June 1397 to try and get a compromise in terms of their relationship with Lithuania, but they didn't concede, so there was still beef. But then on Jadwiga's request, Wenceslaus of Bohemia gave permission for the establishment of a college for Lithuanian students in Prague on the 20th of July 1397. Jadwiga was really passionate about this project, and she issued the college's charter of establishment on the 10th of November, and this is now known as Charles University in Prague, which, funnily enough, I actually thought about doing an exchange in, because I've got quite a good English and film course when I was at uni, but it was like way too expensive, so that put paid to that. She even though she didn't kind of mediate the Teutonic Knights in Lithuania successfully, she did kind of help the Lithuanian cause quite a bit. She was quite good at, she established quite a few positive things that have kind of lasted to this day. So another thing by this point, now at this point Jadwiga's like an old dame, she's like 24 by this point. Jadwiga had no children or pregnancies for over a decade, which is meant to have been a source of frustration between herself and her husband, even though she was 12 when they married and her husband was fucking 35. But let's... Right, Christ. So that was a lot of tension. She wasn't getting pregnant for the ages of 12 to 22. Her husband was frustrated by that, even though he was 35 to 45 at this point. But she did eventually become pregnant in either 1398 or 1399, again, at the ripe old spinster age of 24, 25. She did eventually give birth to a girl, Elizabeth Bonifica, on the 22nd of June 1399 at Wawel Castle. And she was named Elizabeth Bonifica after her mother and Pope Boniface IX, who had agreed to be the child's godfather under this very condition on the 5th of May of that year. So basically, Boniface was like, I'll be our godfather, but you have to name her after me, basically. But this is where it gets really sad as well. So the child only lived for 3 weeks, and then 4 days after the child's death, Jadwiga eventually died as well. So after Jadwiga's death, Stanislav of Skamirec made it known that he had hoped that she would live, because he described Jadwiga as, quote, the spiritual mother of the poor, weak and ill of Poland. And before she died, Jadwiga advised her husband to marry Anna of Sili, which he did eventually do on the 29th of January 1402. Jadwiga and her daughter were interred at Wawel Cathedral, Krakow, on the 24th of August 1399, as per her will, where they remain to this day. Although, this is like a really sad fact that I found out, which I didn't know. On the 12th of July 1949, 550 years after she was buried, the tomb was opened, but nothing remained of the baby. It was just her. I just thought it was really sad. So in terms of her legacy, Jadwiga is agreed by historians as one of Poland's greatest leaders. For somebody so young, she established hospitals, colleges, churches. She restored all the older versions of those things as well. She promoted the singing of hymns and the translation of scripture into Polish. And as per her will, the sale of all of her jewellery on her death was used to partially finance the restoration of the University of Krakow as well. And Jadwiga, because of these acts, and as well as other things, Jadwiga was eventually canonised as a saint by Pope John Paul II, the first Polish Pope, on the 8th of June 1997, nearly 600 years after her death. And just as a wee final thing, because you'll be glad to know this is like my final roundup of Jadwiga's dramatic life, the final thing that I thought you might be interested to know is one of her miracles. that led to her being canonised a saint. So the two best known miracles that are attributed to Jadwiga are Jadwiga's cross and Jadwiga's foot. So according to the latter, so I'll just go with like the Jadwiga's foot story, Jadwiga had taken a piece of jewellery from her foot when she seen a poor stonemason who was begging for help, and she gave it to him. When she left, apparently, the stonemason noticed that her footprint had been left in the plaster floor that he'd been working on, even though it had hardened before she visited. And this footprint can apparently still be seen in the Church of the Visitation of the Blessed Virgin Mary in Krakow, which sadly I didn't go to. It was one of the churches that I didn't see, because if I knew that, I probably would have wanted to like go in and take a wee squadge at the footprint that's apparently still there. But yeah, I didn't, sadly. But yeah, and that brings my little slash big segment on King and Saint Jadwiga to an end.
Thank you so much. I had no idea she existed. It's almost like she's a combination of Mother Teresa and Eleanor of Aquitaine, like a combination of the two. And like, what an interesting life. And the final words that you said, the wee quote about her, like, I think sums up her life. And so, well done. Well done.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. That was really, really interesting, Kelly. Thank you for that.
They should definitely make a film out of her life. 100%. Kind of puts me to shame though. She died at 25, and look at all the stuff that happened in her life and all the stuff that she done, and I'm just like, oh. But amazing, we love her.
Brilliant woman, like badass woman. And now off to Becky for a badass man.
Thank you. So I am going to be very, very briefly talking about, and again, much like Kelly, I apologise in advance for the massacring of the Polish language. I'm really sorry, Anna. But I'm going to be very, very briefly talking about Witold Pileski. Now, if I were to summarise this segment in three words, it would be volunteered for Auschwitz. As insane as that sounds. So, to give you a bit of background information, Witold Pileski was born in 1901 in Poland, which was then part of the Russian Empire. And if we fast forward a decade or two, following the end of the First World War in 1918, Poland re-emerged as a sovereign state, and teenage Pileski joined a subsection of Poland's White Army, and with them helped to disarm retreating German troops before taking up positions in his... in his case, around the city of Wilno, to try and defend it from an oncoming attack by the Soviet Red Army. Unfortunately, however, this didn't really have any effect, and Wilno fell in January 1919, and the teenage Pileski found himself joining the Polish Volunteer Army. He ended up fighting in the Polish-Soviet War for the duration, fighting in the Kiev Offensive, the Battle of Warsaw, and the later liberation of Vilna. And he, despite the fact that at this stage he would have been in his late teens, early 20s, he twice received what translates as the Cross of Valor. I'm not going to try and say the actual Polish name, because, well, I'll be embarrassed, and anyone that speaks even a small smattering of Polish will be mortally offended. So, but yeah, so from his earlier years, he was constantly showing extraordinary bravery and courage in the face of what for many people would be completely overwhelming, you know? After the end of the Polish-Soviet War in 1921, Private Pileski transferred to the Army Reserves, went back to a sort of normal life. I think he ended up being a social worker. He was active in his community. And in 1931, he married Maria Pileska, who was a teacher. They eventually had two kids, but in terms of what I'm talking about today, she doesn't feature that much, unfortunately. So August 1939, and the people of Poland are well aware of what's happening in Germany, and he was mobilised as a commander in the 19th Infantry Division. And in September, the Germans invaded Poland. Unfortunately, his division was almost completely wiped out. Those that survived were folded into the 41st Infantry Division, and he served as second in command to a Major Jan Vodarkovich. Initially, they had some successes. The first battle that the 41st fought saw the division take down 7 German tanks and 4 planes. But ultimately, this had little effect, of course, because the Germans and Russians succeeded in dividing Poland, and the Polish army, as was disbanded in and around October 1939. Instead of doing what I think many people would do, and going back to their homes and trying to wait out the war doing nothing, Pilecki and Wodarkowicz went into hiding in Warsaw, and they established the secret Polish army, which was one of the first underground resistance movements in Poland. Wodarkowicz became the overall leader, but Pilecki commanded the organisation and logistics side of things, and he worked in various low-paid jobs to try and maintain his cover, one of which was as the manager of a cosmetic store. A few months, a few years passed, and Pilecki and Wodarkowicz disagreed ideologically on a few things. Wodarkowicz published a right-wing anti-Semitic manifesto, and it stated that any future Poland had to be Christian, based on national identity, and that those who opposed the idea should be removed from our lands. And that's incredibly incendiary language to be using, and the two men ultimately, they kind of fell out over the issue, and there was resentment and tension between them. And I think that's very interesting, because these two men are kind of the highest ranks of the secret Polish army, and yet they couldn't really stand each other and didn't understand each other. But so in August 1940, Wodarkowicz announced at a meeting of the secret Polish army bigwigs that they would be amalgamating with their rivals, the Union of Armed Struggle, which is a fantastic name for an underground group, and that Pilecki had been nominated to go to Auschwitz. And my understanding of this is that he had no idea that this was even oncoming. So the reason for this is because rumours about the internment camps that had been springing up around Poland had reached Warsaw, and the secret Polish army wanted to gather intelligence on what the fuck was going on. Wodarkowicz said it wasn't an order, but an invitation to volunteer, even though Pilecki saw it as a punishment for refusing to back Wodarkowicz's ideologies. He decided to stick his two fingers up and say, well, fuck you then, I'm going to do it just to spite you. Or at least that's my interpretation of it. So he was given false papers and a new identity under the name of Tomasz Serafinski, and he found out in advance when the Nazis were doing a street roundup, and he willingly went out during this roundup and was caught by the Nazis with around 2,000 civilians. And I just kind of want to point out to our probably one listener somewhere in Newfoundland that this included a man called Vladislaw Bartoszewski, and he is also an incredibly interesting man as well. And if we had more time, I would completely go into his story as well, but I don't, so I won't, but do look him up. But anyway, these 2,000 civilians were held in Warsaw for a couple of days of interrogation and beatings, and then were shipped to Auschwitz on the infamous cattle trains. And Pilecki described his arrival at Auschwitz, and the scenes that he describes, I think, will be of no surprise to anyone. And although they're not quite the horrendous scenes that arise with the development of the camp as a weapon of mass murder, they're still pretty horrendous. So the train arrived, and the Warsaw 2000, who were political prisoners mostly, were dragged off the train, and some were beaten, some were shot. One person was told to run and then shot by the SS. And then the SS soldiers then chose random people also out of that group of arrivals to shoot as punishment for this man trying to escape. But he was only doing what they told him to, which is really disgusting. So yeah, they were taken into the camp. They were asked their profession when they got there. And Pilecki quickly realised that it was the educated prisoners that were attacked. Anyone that was seen to have an educated profession were basically beaten to death. Once this had finished, the prisoners' clothes were removed, their hair was shaved with blunt razors, they were given numbers instead of names, and they were sorted into work details. And Pilecki was assigned number 4859, so he really was one of the first prisoners there. According to Jack Fairweather's amazing biography on Pilecki, which is called The Volunteer, please God, do read it if you have a chance, because it's just gobsmacking and brilliant in equal measure. Pilecki went to the camp with an initial plan to incite an uprising to take it over, but he almost immediately realised that this wasn't going to happen because the prisoners were simply too weak. Prisoners, as soon as they arrived, they were placed on starvation rations, so they would just have been too weak to overthrow the camp guards. They would have needed outside help. Changing his plan, he almost immediately began to recruit people to a resistance movement, and he named this the Union of Military Organizations, or ZAO, within the camp. And what I found really sad about this is that Pilecki quickly realized that he had to be really careful about who to trust. That anyone in the camp could betray him and the resistance movement at any time. Such was the brutality of the conditions and the will to survive in any way possible. And if outing them meant another slice of bread, then people would really consider doing it. And he also realised that he wouldn't be able to save everyone. And I really can't imagine how crushing that would have been. You come to the camp with, you know, almost big dreams of saving everyone, and then realizing that you just can't. That must have been awful. Zal's tasks were to improve inmate morale, as crazy as that sounds, provide news from outside, distribute any extra food they could get their hands on and clothing to people in the camp, and to set up intelligence networks. And Pilecki oversaw all of this in the 3 years that he was there whilst working in the camp and surviving from pneumonia. This is a pretty amazing guy. The intelligence that Zal gathered provided the Polish underground with invaluable information from around October 1940 onwards, and it later formed the Wiltolt report, which was the first comprehensive intelligence report on the atrocities committed at Auschwitz. And these reports were forwarded via the Polish resistance to the British government in London in around about March 1941. So the idea that the Allied forces didn't know what was happening at Auschwitz or any intern camp is just bollocks, quite frankly. Initially, whilst gathering all of this information, Pilecki forbade any written evidence of the atrocities over safety concerns, but he changed his mind when he realised that the only accurate way to preserve the evidence of the crimes committed was to put them on paper. I can't talk for anybody else, but I have kind of always been a bit confused about how the people in the concentration camps and internment camps got the intelligence out. And I finally have an answer, or a couple of answers. Occasionally, prisoners at Auschwitz were released if their families paid large bribes or pulled strings, as was the case with Bartoszewski, who I mentioned earlier. And the underground asked these prisoners to learn an oral report by heart to take to the authorities once they had been let go. If it was me, I would be paranoid that I would be being followed by the SS or you know, agents, and they probably were. So this, I think, adds an extra dimension to that.
I take it these were the political prisoners' families.
Yes.
And not the Jewish families. Because I can't see the SS guards making those, like, giving those liberties to, or not liberty, but, you know, allowing Jewish people to be released, considering how, like, vitriol-filled their agenda was about it.
Well, I know that at the end of the war, there was a train that left Auschwitz that was filled with Jewish prisoners who had basically bought their way out. But I do think at this stage, it was mostly political prisoners. Aside from this, when the resistance started making paper reports, these documents were hidden in hollowed out tools, which were left in fields around the camp. And Jack Fairweather also mentioned that in the local area in Oswiecim, there was a kind of local small resistance movement, and there was a child would wait for prisoners that were marching by a bridge, and if the prisoners were singing or whistling a particular tune, he knew that he could approach them together to pick up papers, because the people on the prisoners had bribed the guards, as the guards sort of looked the other way while this child was handed bundles of paper with reports on them, which, I mean, just in terms of the child, was bloody ballsy. But yeah, that was amazing. And as well as that, by 1942, Pileski's Zhao were also broadcasting details on the number of arrivals and deaths in the camp and the inmates' conditions using a radio transmitter that they had built over several months using smuggled parts. It broadcast for most of that year until the autumn, but it had to be dismantled by Zhao because to quote one of our big fellows, or one of our fellows, Big Mouth, so basically they thought that somebody had mentioned it to somebody that wasn't trustworthy. And I mean, fuck's sake, really? Like, the amount of good that you're doing, and then someone opens their big fucking mouth, it infuriates me. Pileski had been determined when he went into the camp that the information that he could send to the outside would persuade the Allies to help to bomb the camp or invade or just do something. But after a couple of years of imprisonment, no help had been forthcoming. So he decided to break out of the camp in the hope of that him physically being there would persuade either the underground or the Allies to go on the offensive and take over Auschwitz. And I when I was reading this, I thought, oh yeah, he just decided to break out of Auschwitz, because that's so easy. It's not at all well guarded in the slightest. And despite my mocking tone, he did actually manage to escape. He had been assigned to the night shift at the bakery, which was just outside the fence. And he and two other prisoners overpowered a guard, cut the phone line, and escaped on the 26th of April 1943. and they took with them a load of documents that they had stolen from the Germans. Eventually, after a bit of a roundabout route, he managed to report to his superiors, and he pleaded with them to take over Auschwitz. And unfortunately, this was denied. The underground lacked sufficient strength to liberate the camp without Allied help, but Allied help was refused for various reasons. Cam, I know that we've had a couple of conversations about this on the commute into work, and my point kind of still remains the same. I'm still so glad I'm not the person making these decisions, because I can't imagine looking into the face of someone that had survived the horrors of Auschwitz and saying, no, we have to focus our forces elsewhere. I just can't imagine it.
Difficult.
Very.
Very difficult, yeah.
Very difficult. Bizarrely, despite everything that Pulaski had done, he later wrote that he felt guilty. He still felt guilty about the fate of those he didn't save and the lack of action by the Allies, which, I mean, it's not his fault. He went over and above what I think any reasonable person could be asked to do. So I'm so surprised by that. I really am. So following on from his escape from Auschwitz, he later fought in the Warsaw Uprising in 1944. And unfortunately, although that uprising failed and he surrendered to the Germans in October of that year and was sent to a couple of prisoner of war camps before liberation by the US 12th Armored Division in 1945. After this, he remained loyal to the London-based Polish government in exile after the Soviet takeover of Poland, and he volunteered to returned to Warsaw to report on the situation there and to again organise his own intelligence gathering network. He, as before, he worked under a myriad of names and occupations, but the authorities still somehow learnt his real name and his background. And despite repeated demands by the Polish government in exile, he refused to leave Poland. And unfortunately, in 1947, he was arrested by the secret police on charges of working for foreign imperialism. He was imprisoned for a year, and then in 1948, after a sham trial, which, by the way, included testimony from future Prime Minister Józef Serenkiewicz, who was another Auschwitz survivor, Pulaski was found guilty and executed. Despite everything that he had done, information about his heroism was suppressed by the communist regime for 50 years, until 1989. And his children were told that he was an enemy of the state. Can you imagine? That would have been awful.
Horrible.
Yeah, I know. So, yeah, and that... That concludes my very short and probably overly wordy commentary on Wilthold Pulaski.
No, sorry, Becky, it's interesting that you mentioned about kind of Vito Pulaski, and you mentioned about how his children were told that he was an enemy of the state. One of the interesting things that I've been quite reading about recently again is many of the members of Armia Krajowa, the home army, during the communist era were hunted down. Now, I believe the government in Poland, after the Second World War, the communist government announced an amnesty. However, it wasn't really an amnesty, because when they surrendered themselves, they were often either taken to gulags in Russia and the Soviet Union, or they were shot. Most likely, they were actually shot. And even I think it was actually, even up until the 80s, even if you were a member of the Home Army or an affiliated organisation, you weren't allowed to wear your medals. You weren't allowed to even get a pension from the government, despite your service in fighting Nazism. So it's truly, truly despicable.
That's awful. That's so awful.
I think it's just good to remember that
we're talking about, like, this episode is dedicated to heroes, and essentially, yes, they are heroes, and that most heroes have to have tragic stories and tragic endings. And judging from what Kelly said and Becky said, that is the truth here. But we're celebrating the great doings of these people, and that's why this episode is dedicated to them. So, despite we have, we hear of all these tragedies and atrocities, and how, I mean, imagine your children, when you've done so much for your country, your children knowing that you were a traitor, that's horrendous. But at least their memory now is like, the justice has been served, and their memory now is celebrated as opposed to, condemned. Thank you very much, Becky, for another great telling of this hero. And
Next week, I'm
speaking
choosing
of,
the happy one.
yes, it's like quite heavy, but we should be speaking about these things. Thank you very much, Cam. We're moving on to you.
Thank you very much. So, Poland in its history has a wide variety of fantastic leaders, both military in terms of science, playwrights, authors, etc. But I thought I really wanted to focus on someone that was like a kind of a big morale, like a big morale builder, a big morale leader. So I decided to focus on Wojtek the Bear. So just to kind of give you a little bit of a background, in the early days of the Second World War, when Poland was invaded by Germany, the Soviet Union, and Stalin, being the massive dick that he was, decided that he would also invade in Poland. So he came from the east, and the Germans came from the west. And what happened was, is the Soviets, when they were taking the prisoners of war, when they weren't executing them in forests, they were shipping them off to gulags in Siberia. Now, what happened was, is a large amount of these soldiers were shipped off to these gulags, and there was a very famous Polish leader called Władysław Anders, who essentially by 1942, I think at that time, Stalin was kind of like, oh, maybe I've kind of fucked up a little bit here. I need to kind of release some of them, so they can go and fight to fight against the Nazis. Basically, Stalin kind of said, right, you can get released, but you've got to fight in the army. So a lot of them didn't want to fight in the Polish Soviet army, Armia Ludowa. So instead, they decided to go and fight for the British. So Vladislav Anders, well, also known as Anders Army, eventually went from the Soviet Union, and they ended up in Iran. So when the soldiers were in Iran, or some of the soldiers were in Iran, excuse me, sorry, there was a regiment called the Polish 22nd Transport Artillery Supply Company. So it was a company. A group of these soldiers came across a young Iranian boy who was wandering through the desert, and he was carrying a large cloth sack. So the men thought the boy looked tired and hungry, and they said to him, why don't you come over? We'll give you some food and, take care of you and stuff like that. So the kid was like, okay, yeah, that's perfect. So they all sat down, and they're all chatting away and stuff like that. And the Pole said to the wee boy, he said, what's in your bag? And the wee boy goes, oh, it's a bear. So they're like, all right, okay, cool. So he opens up the bag, and here's this little cub. Wasn't in good nick, needed a lot of attention, a lot of care, and stuff like that. So the Polish soldiers were like, I'll tell you what, if we'll buy the bear off you, we'll give you some money and stuff like that. So we're like, oh, okay, no worries. So the wee boy gets his money and buggers off, and then the
I
Pole
love the
take the
idea
bear.
that he's just wandering
He's
around
just
with a bear in his backpack.
Yeah, that. You know what? I've never actually really been able to find out more about that. I just assumed that he had a bear in his backpack, because I think that's what people did at the time. Maybe. Fuck. I don't know. But anyway, he had his wee bear in his backpack, and he goes, okay, right, I'll fucking sell it to you. The Poles go, yeah, brilliant, so we'll take it. So the Polish soldiers began taking care of this little bear. And they decided to name him Wojtek, which, interestingly enough, Wojtek is kind of like the nickname of the name of Wojciech, which comes from an old Slavic kind of like name, which means happy warrior, which is quite funny because I think that's quite good when I go later on in the podcast, later on in my segment, sorry, excuse me. So Wojtek initially had problems with kind of like eating and drinking. So what they did is they got condensed milk, right, and put it in an old vodka bottle. And they would also give him like fruit and marmalade and all these kind of other things as well, kind of like off, you know, like different kind of foods. And what they used to kind of reward him with, and I always thought this was quite funny, is used to when they made Wojtek better and stuff like that, they used to give him beer. So used to kind of give him like kind of beer and stuff like that, and another treat used to give him was cigarettes. So he actually enjoyed smoking or eating cigarettes, and he also drank coffee as well. So to be fair, he's not unlike myself, really, smoking, drinking beer, drinking coffee. You know, I like to think of myself as a kind of like a human Scottish Wojtek almost. You know what I mean? He also enjoyed wrestling with the other soldiers as well. That's something that they taught him to do as a bit of a laugh and stuff like that. And interesting enough, Wojtek would also sleep with the other soldiers when it was really, really cold at night. So even though he's playing Big Spoon, Little Spoon with the soldiers, he was also taught to salute as well when he was greeted. This is something that I also found quite funny as well. Like, imagine this big fuck-off bear, and, you know, you're walking through the camp, and it's like, you know, attention! And then, like, there's the bears like that, saluting you. Like, that's fucking cool. So, anyway. So, excuse me, sorry. So, he became the unofficial mascot for this particular company, the 22nd Company in Poland. And basically what kind of happened was is the soldiers were eventually assigned to Italy, and they were essentially assigned to fight at the Battle of Monte Cassino. So basically what kind of happens is the British army at the time had a kind of like a law rule, right? And essentially they weren't allowed to take any pets with them when they were going on, you know, when they're being deployed and stuff like that. So the Polish soldiers kind of thought to themselves, how can we get around this? And I can just imagine them all sitting there with like their cigarettes and their beer, and Wojtek just wrestling with some Polish soldier, and they're all laughing and joking. And one guy goes, I've got a fucking great idea. And he goes, let's make him a soldier. And that's what they did. They enlisted Wojtek as a private, and they made sure that he would basically become a soldier. So he got his own kind of like ration book. He got his own fucking pay book. I don't know about a uniform. I don't think he ever had one of those, if I'm being honest. But I think he had pretty much everything else, you know what I mean, that a normal soldier would have had at the time. Even had a serial number as well. I mean, that's kind of funny. Imagine looking through that roster and just kind of going, you know, we've got, you know, Pavel Slavinsky, we've got Domislav, da-da-da, and then we've got, Wojtek the bear. Ah, okay, Spockle, cool, like that. We serial number and stuff like that. I think that's quite cool, right? So anyway, time comes. Battle of Monte Cassino. As many people probably know, Monte Cassino was one of the most hard battles that the Allies fought against the Axis in the whole of the Second World War. The Germans were fucking entrenched, like they were not moving not even a millimeter. You know what I mean? They were like, no, we are not fucking moving. So the Poles, especially the artillery regiments, were kind of brought in to really kind of like fucking soften up the Germans just so they can overrun them. So during the Battle of Monte Cassino, Wojtek was used to help carry artillery shells and ammunition crates to the Polish soldiers when they were firing artillery. And like he would just bring them up, he'd stack them up in that. He copied the soldiers when they were doing it, and he would take them over and stuff like that. Now, despite the fact that the fucking Germans are shooting at him, they're fucking bombing them and stuff like that, he never once flinched. He kept on fucking going, and he kept on supplying the Polish soldiers. He was fucking brilliant, right? And I like to kind of think that during the Battle of Monte Cassino, like, you know, there's fucking bullets whizzing everywhere, there's fucking artillery shells going down, and Wojtek's like, you know, which is kind of like bear speak, like bear Polish speak, for like Zarchizna, which is like the Polish for like for the fatherland, and I reckon he fucking did that. Like, he's got to have done it, because, you know, he's a fucking awesome bear. You know?
Like, can you imagine definitely being on the other side and seeing this big-ass bear? Like, it's so funny.
Fuck, comrades, what is that big hairy thing? That man needs a show. Fuck, it's a bear.
You know what? That definitely happened. It would have definitely had to happen. But anyway, so Battle of Monte Cassino, eventually the Polish troops, the Allies and the Poles helped it massively in the Battle of Monte Cassino, I believe the fourth battle it was. They eventually broke through the lines, and in kind of like for a reward for Wojtek's service, he was promoted to the rank of corporal. That was in part due to his, due to his efforts in the during the battle, along with his popularity. And subsequently, Wojtek essentially became the insignia for the 22nd Artillery Supply Company. If you ever see it, it's a picture of a bear carrying a fucking howitzer shell, which is fucking badass. So, unfortunately, as much as this is one of my favourite stories and it's nice and stuff like that, it doesn't necessarily... Well, kind of got a happy ending, but not truly happy. So, after the Second World War, 1945, the Polish soldiers are transported back to the UK and they end up in Scotland, in Berwickshire. And basically, you know... Unfortunately, due to Stalin being a massive knob, many of the soldiers weren't allowed to return home, back to Poland. So many of them decided to settle in the UK. And when they were demobbed in November of 1947, Wojtek was given to Edinburgh Zoo, where he spent the rest of his life. He was visited by journalists, a lot of kind of like his Polish soldiers that he served with would come and see him. And I always think this is just fucking brilliant. I can just imagine it right now, like Wojtek's in his fucking pen and stuff like that. He's just kind of like sitting there chilling. And the Polish soldiers, what they would sometimes do is apparently, like the old Polish soldiers, they would jump into the pen with them and have a bit of a rustle tussle with them. And what they would also do is they would actually throw him cigarettes. Which I just, you know, I'm not like saying this is a good thing, okay, right? Like, just please appreciate that, like, you know, giving
good
cigarettes to, like,
a
you know,
smoker.
Yeah, well, you know, it's bad because he's like an animal, but I do think it's like fucking hysterical. I can just see like soldiers going, yeah, cigarette, Barbarossa, kurva match, like that, just fucking throwing them fucking cigarettes.
It was their pal. They're just like, oh, cold friend, here you go.
Yeah, no, definitely. He was obviously their pal and stuff like that, but I still kind of think, like, you really shouldn't be giving a bear cigarettes. Like, you shouldn't really give anyone cigarettes. But, you know, like, you know what, we'll leave it, you know what I mean? Because there's different times and stuff like that. Yeah, he was, but yeah. But anyway, so, sadly, Wojtek dies in 1963 at the age of 21 in Edinburgh Zoo. And it's... I've always liked this story because I always kind of feel that it's like it's a Polish Scottish story. You know what I mean? Like more Polish than kind of anything else, to be quite frankly honest. So one of the things that I found quite profound was the fact that my wife. I love my darling wife. But when I first asked her about Wojtek the Bear, I was kind of like, you know, do you know about him? She was kind of like, no, I've never heard of him. And then when I went to Poland and met her family, I asked a lot of them as well. Do you know about this? You know, but this bear, you know, he's fucking awesome. You know, he beat the Nazis and that. And they were just kind of like, we don't know who he is. And it was very, you know, it was a story that wasn't told for quite a long time, which is quite sad. But the good thing is, if anybody's ever in Edinburgh and they decide to take a walk through Princess Street Gardens, you can actually see a bronze statue of Wojtek.
Is that what that bear is?
Yeah, that's the bear, that's
I
Wojtek!
I always wondered... Really? Oh, I never
that
knew!
None of you knew
it! No, I just thought it was a random... Well, to be fair, I never really went close enough up to read it, but I remember it when I first seen it. I was like, why is there a bear in Princess Street Gardens? Like a statue of a bear. And I was like, oh, I must go up and read it one day and see what it is, and I never ever done it.
But see, how they have cows everywhere in the city. How would you know that this bear is special?
Because it's a statue of a bear.
Has he not got like an army hat and stuff on?
He's got an army guy next to him.
I knew there was some, but oh, that's, see, it makes sense now. Oh.
So one thing that I don't know why, but I just found this like really, really funny, right? So Wojtek's company was part of the Polish Second Corps, okay? And they had like an armament list of what they kind of had in terms of kind of like guns, etc. So it reads out 248 pieces of artillery, 288 anti-tank guns, 234 anti-aircraft guns, 264 tanks, 1,241 APCs, 440 armoured cars, 12,064 cars, and one Syrian brown bear, Wojtek. So I love how they kept. I just think it's fucking brilliant.
Well, I mean, any advantage you can get, you need to take it.
Exactly, exactly. And yeah, so that kind of concludes my wee segment on Wojtek the Soldier Bear.
Thank you very much, Cal. I'm blown away that this like statue in Princess Street Gardens is like the bear you just talked about. So I had no idea. I'll be more inquisitive in the future about things I see in the city. Full of mysteries, the city it is. Now, we do have a bit of time, so I think it would be a great bonus for Becky to briefly talk about another badass lady of Poland, namely Marie Curie. Becky?
Okay, so very quickly, just to talk about Marie Curie. Polish-born, naturalised French, Marie Curie was born in Warsaw in 1867, and she is remarkable because she conducted pioneering research on radioactivity at a time when women as scientists were not particularly welcomed by the scientific community. She was the first woman to win a Nobel Prize and the only person to win in multiple sciences. She won two Nobel Prizes. The first was in physics in 1903, which she shared with her husband Pierre and friend Henri Becquerel. And this was for recognition of the extraordinary services they have rendered by their joint researches on the radiation phenomena discovered by Professor Becquerel. And the second Nobel Prize that she won was in chemistry in 1911 in recognition of her services to the advancement of chemistry by the discovery of the elements radium and polonium. Now, these in of themselves make her a leader as a scientist and also as a woman. But I just kind of want to... Now, another thing that she did, which I also think makes her a brilliant leader as well as a woman, during World War One, Curie saw the need for field radiological centres near the front lines to assist battlefield surgeons to allow them to operate on wounded soldiers as quickly as possible. And after a quick study of radiology, anatomy and automotive mechanics, she procured X-ray equipment, vehicles, auxiliary generators and developed mobile radiography units, which popularly became known as Little Curies. She set up France's first military radiology centre, and it was operational by late 1914. So just to put that into perspective, she didn't know stuff. She learned stuff. She set up a radiology centre on a front line in the middle of the World War. She's absolutely boss. After the war, she began training other women in sciences and as aides, and was the first woman to become a professor at the University of Paris. So not to go too much into it, but I hope that just kind of very briefly explains why she is just such a goddess.
Have they not, they've done a film as well with Rosamund Pike playing her that I really want to see. It was due to come out before COVID-19 shat all over the film industry, but yes. I seen the poster for it last time I was in the cinema. It looked really good.
I am very excited to see that as well. And, you know, just a shout out there to Rosamund Pike, who is just brilliant.
She is. And thank you very much, Becky. That was Marie Curie. And I've got three more Marias to mention briefly that were like unbelievably badass women in Polish history. We've got Maria Kotarba, who was a courier in the Polish resistance movement, and she was smuggling messages and supplies among the local partisan party. Now, she eventually was arrested by Gestapo, and she was sent to the Nazi Auschwitz camp, but where she, another woman called Lina Mankowska, was there deported by the Germans. And what Maria Kotarba did was she repeatedly helped Lena while they were in Auschwitz, and that resulted in both women being among the thousands of prisoners to be evacuated by, sorry, to be like liberated in the end. And basically, they saw each other for the last time back in January 1945, and Lena spent her entire life trying to trace Maria. Which eventually she did after way after Maria had passed away. Now, another Maria was Maria Denisau or Niso, was a Polish woman soldier, and she, during the occupation she was liaison soldier of the Armia Krajowa, and in her apartment she organized a contact point and a hiding place for Jewish people, which is I think incredibly amazing at the time. And
Dangerous too.
exactly, and badass woman. In August 1944, she took part in the Warsaw Uprising, and that brings me to Maria Witek, who I discovered because of Becky, one of the most incredible women in the Polish history. There's a huge queue of achievements. Listen to this, right? She served in the Polish army since she was 18 years old. She became the first Polish woman to be promoted to brigadier. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Brigadier.
Brigadier, right? In 1991, she became the first female student in the mathematics department of Kiev University. She joined the Polish military organization. In 1919, she joined the Polish army group that was fighting the Bolsheviks in Ukraine. In 1920, she was a member of the Women's Volunteers Group, and she fought in the Battle of Lviv, apologies, Anna. And she was awarded the highest
Leave
Polish medal for the first time. Lvov, yes, that's the one, Lvov. And she was awarded the highest Polish medal for the first time. She then was the commander of an organization training women for military service. She was appointed the head of the women's division at the Institute of Physical Education and Military Training in Bielawni, near Warsaw. During the invasion of Poland in 1939, I mean, the list is ever ending, she was the commanding officer of the Women's Military Assistance Battalions. In October 39, she joined an underground team, let's say, group, which later became the Home Army. And she was head of Women's Army Services on the staff of Gen. She fought, sorry, in the Warsaw Uprising and was promoted to lieutenant colonel. Sorry, is that the American
Lieutenant Colonel.
pronunciation? Okay, Lieutenant Colonel here, sorry, okay. And then she initiated the establishment of the Commission of the History of Women, and she was then appointed, she was, well, she eventually became the first Polish woman to attain the rank of general. Like, wow. Like,
She is amazing.
what? She's what? And all that she did, like, during the most turbulent times in the history of Poland. Like, I mean, can you imagine that for a woman to be such a badass and to be able to be the first in so many things, plus the Mathematica department, which at the time that was a man thing to do. You know, women were not allowed in, and women didn't have the same means. Anyway, she was badass. Apologies for getting carried away. So yeah, and that would conclude the segment of amazing Polish leaders. A woman, a man, a bear, and a few more women named Maria's, all of them. And thank you very much to everyone. And now, shall we move on to our quiz of the day?
Sure, yeah.
Starting. Question number one. Which Polish astronomer is the most famous in the world?
Copernicus.
Yes. Can you elaborate us on what he did?
Oh, Copernicus.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to be brutally honest. I actually don't know. The only reason why I know of Copernicus is because there's actually a vodka in Poland named after him, which I quite like.
That is such a Cam thing to say.
It's fair enough.
Hashtag things that Cam says. There's a vodka, so I know what it's called.
He moved the earth and stopped the sun because at the time people thought that it was the other way around. So that was pretty big. But thank you very much, Cameron. Question number two. Now, where can one find the salt mines?
Veselinka.
Oh, yes.
Katowice?
Sorry, Kelly.
Valeska.
I mean, Valeska. Okay, you're all correct, but Becky was the first one, so. That one goes to Becky,
Yeah,
but
but I
well done,
probably
well
said
done.
it really lot wrong. I'm sorry, Anna. I'm sorry.
Indeed. It's like, is it, wasn't it like an inspiration or doesn't it look like the Moria mines in The Lord of the Rings?
Oh, I
It does
didn't
actually.
know.
I never thought about that when I was there, but yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Question number three. Apologies for the pronunciation. The Jagiellonian University, founded by King Casimir III the Great in 1364, is it the first or second oldest uni in Europe?
Second.
Yes, that's very correct, actually. Well done.
That was
The
a
first one
great
was it?
guess.
Was it a
What's the
guess?
oldest?
So the first one was created in Prague, and I was only 16 years before that. So technically, yeah, these two are the first ones. So the Prague one was the first one in Europe. Now this one is for Cameron, I think. So vodka is, as we all know, the traditional Polish alcohol, and almost every Polish person has tried vodka for once. It was the most popular alcohol served at all weddings, birthday parties, and anniversaries for years. Now, how much percentage of alcohol is included typically in Polish vodka?
40.
Oh my God, you're actually
Oh
right.
my
Actually,
God,
the
actually, right.
correct answer is between 40 and 50% of alcohol. And apparently, there's 260 million liters of vodka being produced in Poland every year.
That doesn't surprise me, if I'm being honest.
I read that like the Polish production of the alcohol has been quite strong since the Middle Ages, and apparently every peasant and nobleman could produce their own type of liqueur, which I think is fascinating to know that everyone could do it.
Can I just do a tiny wee segment about vodka?
Yeah.
Very quickly. Okay, so from what can I gather, the origins of vodka, it was actually like a medicine developed in the 1500s in Poland, but it had a different name, and it kind of like grew up as a kind of like a drink and stuff like that. And eventually, by the time you get the kind of like the 1700s, vodka is kind of like quite mass produced across Poland. And supposedly, the idea is the better the spring water that you use to make a vodka or make vodka, the less bad hangover you're gonna kind of get. And interestingly enough, I believe it was in the 1970s, and one of the main sticking points between the communist government in Poland and the government of the Soviet Union was the origins behind vodka. The Soviet Union wanted to promote it as a kind of like a Russian kind of drink that started in the 1600s, but the Poles were like, nah, it's a fucking Polish drink. So even to this day, I still actually believe there's like, I don't know if it's like trademarks, or you know how you get like specially protected foods and drinks? I actually still think there's like ongoing kind of like court battles and stuff like that between Russia and Poland on the origins of vodka.
Wow, thank you very much, Cameron. That's very interesting to know. Was that Anna or was that you?
No, that was me. I found out about that. I like vodka.
You. Thanks. Question number five. Which was the first capital of Poland?
Krakow.
Krakow?
Krakow.
Actually, that's I thought so too. I mean, I hope I'm not wrong, but apparently the very first one was Gniezno, no, Gniezno, then it was Krakow, and then now it's Warsaw.
I think it is, yeah, Miesnov,
Gniezno, I think it's pronounced, I'm not sure. Question number six. Okay, name, what's that question? Name a Polish pope.
John Paul II.
Question number seven. Name a Polish Nobel winner.
Marie Curie.
Yes! So, Becky, question number eight. What was Marie Curie famous for?
Discovery of radium and polonium.
Off. Number nine. Now, very interesting one. How many heritage sites does Poland have? 9, 13, or 16?
13.
16?
16, indeed. That is like crazy. 16, yes. And now, when did Poland declare itself a republic independent of Russia?
1918.
Nineteen eighteen.
Yes, guys. I was going to say it was
Nineteen.
the 11th of November of which year? 1918. Well done. You were
Yay.
amazing. And that concludes the quiz for today's podcast. Well done. Thank you everyone for listening, and thank you to my friends for contributing to this amazing podcast. Have a good week, and we'll see you again next week. Enjoy and take care of yourselves. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.